Hi, everybody. We are on season 9, episode 2 of the Practical Protection Podcast, and I have Matt back with me for season 9. Hi, Matt. How are you doing?
Hi, Catherine. Yeah, very, very well. You'll be very glad to know that I'm well rested from a 2-week cruise in the Caribbean, as you always like
very nice.
My holidays. I know you look forward to questioning me on them.
Absolutely. And what's next?
five or six days in Malta, I believe. Ooh. Which is nice. Potentially not as exotic as the Caribbean, but the one thing that I need to warm my very old bones is heat and sun. Yes. So I'll be very glad to not get away from the UK exactly, but when I look out of the window and see it's pouring with rain and blowing a gale, maybe I'm telling a fib. I don't know. But yeah, very well. Thank you very much indeed. How are you keeping?
I am very well, thank you. And just in case anybody hears any noises in the background or anything, we are recording this during the Easter Bank holidays. I do have a 9-year-old near me. He is on a computer. He has a headset on. He is a child that needs movements and sound and energy constantly. So hopefully he's not going to carry on beatboxing, which he has been doing for a little bit. But it could distract me. If I suddenly seem distracted at any point, it could be that I'm giving a little bit of side eye. But he's done incredibly well, I have to say. He's been lovely. Absolutely. And quiet for me at the moment.
I would ask what beatboxing is, by the way, but let's not go there.
Oh, just, yeah, just it's whatever sound he can make with his mouth, basically. Pretty much it. That's his level of it. But yeah, no, everything is good. We're going away for a week doing lots and lots of stuff, which obviously means that after the week I have to recover from being away for a week. And yeah, just hopefully just a lot of nice family time. But let's get straight into our podcast today. I think we're going to have a scone and scone moment, I have to say, because we're talking about hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And Matt, you say hypertrophic. So cardiomyopathy.
Yes.
Yeah. So we're going to be, so just the listeners, it's just going to, well, we're both Northern, so I don't understand why we're doing it, but it just shows that there's even differences between us Northern folk in the way that we're going to be doing it. And anyway, we're going to be looking at hypertrophic cardiomyopathy and what can be available when you apply for protection insurance. So this is the Practical Protection Podcast. So everybody, just a little bit of background. There's not really much background on this unless we're going into like super, super medical stuff.
Yeah, sure.
And obviously I'll let Matt get into all of that. But it's pretty much quite, you know, straightforward in a sense. So hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, sometimes abbreviated to HCM, so Hotel Charlie Mike. It's basically where the heart wall becomes thicker than usual. So that's the muscle wall. It would usually be what's in the left ventricle. It can be in a slightly different position, but I will let Matt explain that because it's not really my area to know that too much. We've got about 1 in 500 people in the UK have it. I got that from the British Heart Foundation charity, which actually surprised me. That's a lot more people than I thought it would be. But yeah, so anyway, there is that there. And you might be wondering, obviously, where this would go in terms of protection insurance application. Obviously, if the person themselves has it, it would clearly go in the heart condition section. But what's really interesting is that it is typically a genetic link. So, you know, it can be, you know, it's not necessarily it's not listed necessarily in the family medical questions on protection insurance. But, you know, a lot of insurers will say any other genetic condition in your family or any genetic condition that you've potentially been screened for. And now this is really, really interesting because we're going into that kind of genetic screening and stuff like that. And most of us will know in the insurance world, in the protection insurance world, that we don't need to volunteer genetic testing for when we're applying for life insurance and critical illness cover, income protection, up to a certain amount of sum assured. And over that sum assured, we would need to declare if we'd been tested for Huntington's disease. But what's really interesting is that this thing of like not asking about the genetic testing is the fact that they might not ask about the genetic testing in the sense of have you had genetic tests, but there can be that question in the family medical history of, you know, have you been, you know, suggested to have genetic testing due to a family history or anything like that. So it can still be kind of captured elsewhere. So that, it's kind of like pops into my mind. So there's somebody I've been helping recently And obviously you do go through your usual questions in terms of medical history, things like that, and family medical history. And you do mention things like cancer, heart attack, stroke, anything to do with their kidneys, Parkinson's, you know, when we're doing our initial chat, not doing the application in itself. And, you know, for one person I was helping recently, they're like, oh, well, you know, my siblings have a cardiomyopathy. And I was like, okay, well, what type? And, you know, you really need to build down into that, because the hypertrophic cardiomyopathy will, in the family history, fall into quite a lot of insurers' question sets. So then, Matt, can you take us through what hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is, please, and what it is doing to the body?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll probably just go back to some key words here. I'm pretty sure that most of our listeners, particularly if they tune in regularly, will have heard us talk about the heart, its chambers, its pumping chambers, the left ventricle, and so on and so forth. So I'm probably, Catherine, maybe if I can use you as the balance here, if yeah. I start talking jargon, which you think I need to explain a little bit more, do say so.
I know, really hard.
You normally do anyway, but...
I know, but it's quite tricky because I'm such a nerd. So I'm just going to absolutely love everything that you're saying. But no, I'll listen out for the technical things. And when if I feel my eyes squinting a little bit like, what? Then I'll go, yeah. Right, okay, that's a moment we should probably clarify, okay?
As I say, it's more around structure of the heart and so on and so forth when I talk the left ventricle or the ventricles or heart muscle. But either which way, if I can just go back to some key words here, we just go back literally to hypertrophic for me,
yeah.
Cardiomyopathy, hypertrophy, I think everybody will feel generally okay with that term, but basically it means just an increase in growth of muscle cells themselves, and it generally refers to an increase in muscle size, opposite to atrophy. So yeah. that would hopefully we can link in. In terms of cardiomyopathy, what exactly does that mean? Well, it's a very general term, not specific, but what it actually is, it reflects is any disorder that affects the heart muscle. And I'm kind of making an assumption, like extremely dangerous, I know, that everybody can remember really what the heart consists of, four chambers. The great pumping side of the heart, which is the left side of the heart, the left atrium, and the left ventricle. Okay, now these are chambers from which the blood flows into that side of the heart, goes through the mitral valve, the blood is squeezed out of that chamber into the left ventricle, and then it's squeezed out through the aortic valve.
Yeah.
Okay, and effectively, if we just go back to cardiomyopathy, it is a disorder that affects the heart muscle. So it's very much the heart muscle. We're not talking coronary artery disease, which literally is the arteries that feed the heart muscle. We're not talking about the valves so much today, although they are cardiomyopathies can touch on those, on the valves. We're actually talking about the muscle itself. So any other muscle, but the heart muscle is obviously extremely important because it pumps blood around the heart. Okay, now in terms of cardiomyopathy in its most general sense, as I say, it is a disease of the heart muscles, and where the walls of the chambers have become stretched, thickened, or stiff. So the heart chamber is the trying to think of a best way to describe it. Let's go back to what I've just said. A chamber that sits within the heart itself, the left ventricle being a classic example. So it's where the muscle itself becomes stretched, thickened, or stiff. It can occur in very young people. Importantly, if I can just flag the next two sentences or my next two comments with you, because if I want to go to the ratings, the underwriting ratings to this condition, it tends to be progressive.
Yeah.
And it can worsen pretty quickly.
Right.
So I think those are two things just to remember here. And it can be associated with diseases involving other organs, which kind of roots back to the actual, the current thinking on the causes of some cardiomyopathies. So effectively, and I point this out because I think whilst we've got the heart muscle itself, and if it loses its ability to pump the blood around the body effectively, then that is going to, by definition, is quite obviously, hopefully, that will start to cause problems. But also the heart rhythm can also be disturbed, and that's also important to note as well. So it technically, a word that you may hear is arrhythmias, which effectively is just simple technical term for irregular heartbeats. And it is those arrhythmias which can result in sudden death.
Yeah.
Okay, so as opposed to the blood pumping or not being able to be pumped effectively, it's the actual arrhythmias that result in sudden death. The pumping action will, if it goes on and on and on over many, many years, will cause heart failure. Okay, but the arrhythmias are definitely linked to the sudden death elements of it. Okay, just very quickly go through the different types of cardiomyopathy, because I think that whilst hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is a distinct type of cardiomyopathy, you will get others. In fact, dilated cardiomyopathy, which is the first one I'll just go through very, very quickly. I had a case on last week of this. Now, this is where the left ventricle, which we've talked about, is the main pumping chamber, and it becomes enlarged, okay? And that's very common throughout all these cardiomyopathies, as I've already mentioned. It's the most common type of cardiomyopathy.
Dilated one.
Dilated, that's right. And it effectively, again, compromises the heart's ability to pump normally and then relax after the left ventricle has squeezed the blood out around the body. It can squeeze out, but then it needs to relax as well. So if you can think about it, the muscle needs to be a fairly... it needs to work properly, let me put it that way, rather than anything else. Now, just picking up on the issues of genetics here, dilated cardiomyopathy is rarely inherited. Okay. Most often it's seen in adults ranging from the ages of 20 to 60, but also can be diagnosed at all ages, including children. It's the one cardiomyopathy, to the best of my knowledge, that is more common in men than women. And if we think about the left ventricle and its important role in the body, dilated cardiomyopathy is the leading cause of heart transplant.
Okay.
So if you can almost say, think here, that arrhythmias don't generally occur as often with this one. This is one where the left ventricle cannot work properly, and therefore the heart has to be replaced in its entirety. And just kind of touching on the theme of the causes of some of the cardiomyopathies, dilated, noting I was saying that it's rarely inherited, it can be caused by chronic heavy alcohol abuse.
Okay.
Associated nutritional deficiencies. With alcohol, very heavy alcohol abuse, people don't often don't look after themselves from a food perspective. And the nutritional deficiencies themselves can impact the way that the heart muscle works. If you just think, maybe if you're deficient nutritionally, if I can spit it out, there's lots of muscles in your body that will start to will not get the benefit of all of the nutrients, and it's exactly the same with the heart. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's dilated. That was a very quick run through. Hypertrophic, as Catherine, you actually mentioned yourself, and I've mentioned a couple of times now, so this is where the muscle of the left ventricle thickens. There are actually two types of HCM, that wonderful abbreviation. So hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, there are two types. One, you'll often hear, well, certainly by underwriters anyway, You will call it HOCOM, HOCM, which is hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy. That's
yeah.
the most common. 70% of cases are HOCOM. And it was also historically, I must admit, I can't remember hearing, bear in mind I've been around a long time, the group of words, but hey-ho, everything I've looked at does mention it. So it's historically referred to as idiopathic hypertrophic subaortic stenosis.
All right, just that short sentence, yeah.
Just that, exactly, yes. Idiopathic, just in case people are not familiar with that, really means that there's no obvious cause to why this hypertrophic subaortic stenosis actually occurs. But basically, it's a narrowing of an area underneath the aortic valve. It's like a membrane, apparently, which will stop the blood being pumped out of the heart properly. This is where the obstruction word comes from. It's being obstructed from leaving the left ventricle. Now, this is, I believe, definitely a genetic disorder.
Yeah.
And it is, again, it's a significant cause of sudden cardiac death in young people. Okay.
Yeah.
There's a second type, which is the less common one, which is HNCP, which is basically hypertrophic non-obstructive cardiomyopathy. And again, you're not generally going to get the severity of the symptoms that you get with HOCOM because there isn't this obstruction caused by this membrane. But nevertheless, it is certainly pretty important, from a life expectancy perspective.
Yeah.
There are 4 stages of cardiomyopathy. I really just wanted to flag this with people, but I must admit they are regular listeners will talk to me about how the medical profession do like to classify and put stages around various disorders, primarily so that they can identify treatments or levels of treatment. And there are 4 stages of cardiomyopathy generally. But basically, from an underwriting perspective, they are not that relevant. What you will see in terms of classifications, and one which will certainly been heard of, or at least read by a lot of advisors, is the New York Classification of Heart Failure, NYHA.
Yeah.
Which you will see in the cardiomyopathy definition for critical illness. And I just thought these are classifications specifically around heart failure, which is a major complication of cardiomyopathy. So I thought I'd just whip through them, what they actually mean. So class 1 is no limitation of physical activity. Okay, yeah. So you have a cardiomyopathy, but there's no limitation of physical activity. Class 2 is slight limitation. Class 3, marked limitation. And class 4 is symptoms occurring at rest, discomfort, or you get discomfort with any physical activity. I mention this again because in terms of underwriting at new business, then the insurers, the underwriters, will only take on class 1 lives in the context of this particular classification. So class 2, 3, and 4, I'm afraid no insurance is available. In terms of critical illness claims, then the definitions state that the individual, in order to make a valid claim, amongst other things, by the way, are at least a class 3, so that is marked limitation.
Yeah.
Of their heart function, so it must be at least class 3 to get to be paid out on a critical illness claim. But that's a big difference between class 1, which is what the underwriters need to see for taking on the policy in the first place. There are 2 other types. There are 5 types of cardiomyopathy as far as I can see, but they are very rare. And one of them is restrictive cardiomyopathy, where the heart fills very poorly, which is the most common thing, and it doesn't squeeze the blood out of the body. That's the less common one. But that's not thought to be inherited either. Other types, left ventricular non-compaction and atherogenic left ven right ventricular dysplasia. I know you like these long medical terms, Catherine, so this is why I particularly put these in for you,
Thank
especially
you.
because I was thinking of you.
Where I
Sorry.
just saw I roll my eyes at people and go, could you have not made it simpler for us all?
Yeah, well, yeah. I do like to make life, yeah, and I'm only putting your leg, as you know.
Oh, I know.
Okay, so looking at the symptoms, does that help in terms of what the cardiomyopathies actually are and
Yeah.
where hypertrophic cardiomyopathy fits in, the fact that you've got three
Absolutely.
subtypes, what is gonna cause the problems around the blood flow not getting around the body properly, and also the arrhythmias that it causes.
I think it's really useful because, for anybody
That's
who's
good.
not sure about, because obviously as an advisor, a lot of the time we might come across a condition and some conditions sort of, and you think, actually that probably does make this person a higher risk of dying or potentially making a critical illness claim, because you can see it, with some of them, it's really easy to sort of like see that this condition actually is going to be seen as higher risk by the insurer. And I always think that hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, it's kind of lost amongst it's I don't think it's something I mean, obviously I don't think I ever heard of it before I started advising and before I started like really specializing in the underwriting and the understanding the risk side of things. And I don't think a lot of people would hear that or hear of a family member having it and think, oh yeah, that's actually really quite a quite a risky condition in terms of, like obviously you're saying there about like the young sudden death and things like that, and
Yeah.
the difficulties it's then presenting to the rest of the body and the organs. Obviously, I think you obviously all the organs are so important, but the heart, the brain, they are so vital to everything working as we expect it to. So I think that was really, really useful because it really hit home that actually this is a lot of stuff happening with the heart, and some obviously sometimes it can really, really increase the risk of death. In other times, it's not necessarily a huge increase of risk, but it is something where, it is it's something, it is there, and it is the heart is having to work in a different way to what we would usually expect, and it has more strain on it, which over a long period of time, especially, that's got to have some kind of impact.
Yeah,
So that
no,
was
very
really
much so.
useful.
Yeah, as I say, I think we've covered off now in terms of a relatively recent podcast. We've covered off heart valves. We've talked about coronary artery disease, and now we've actually talked about the heart muscle itself. So as you say, there are a wide variety of conditions that affect us all, and yeah, it just underlines the importance of the heart to us. But the heart, as I say, there's a lot to it. It's not just simply something that thuds in your chest, let me put it that way.
Yeah.
So perhaps it's not surprisingly, bear in mind what I've been talking about in terms of the impact on efficient blood flow around the body, and also the fact that the muscle isn't working, it can throw out the electrical conduction of the heart, therefore leading to regular heartbeats, arrhythmias, and so on and so forth. That the symptoms themselves are shortness of breath, that was the most common one, with the swelling of the ankles, feet, legs, and stomach, and as well as heart palpitations, where the heartbeat feels rapid or it's pounding or fluttering. And chest pain, not surprisingly, is another common feature. Along with shortness of breath, you're going to get fatigue potentially. And with the fact that oxygen isn't being pumped around the body, as well as this particular issue around irregular heartbeats, then you could get lightheadedness and fainting. So those are the most common symptoms that you get. Causes, we've obviously spoken about genetic mutations, but we've also talked about the fact that some of the cardiomyopathies are not thought to be genetic or have a very significant genetic influence, but virus infections are seen as a major cause. And how many times have we said that, Catherine, during our podcasts about viruses?
I know.
It's quite incredible how often viral infections crop up. It does make you think, maybe, that when people or the clinicians don't really know what's going on, they blame it on a virus. But it comes up too often, I think, for you know, no smoke without fire type of saying.
Yes.
We talked about nutritional deficiency. We talked about the uncontrollable heart rhythms. Alcohol abuse we've talked about as well.
Yeah.
So I think one of the ones that I was particularly interested was certain medicines can cause cardiomyopathies as well. Particularly certain types of chemotherapy for cancer, which, as you know, is having had chemotherapy for cancer, that was, oh, I hadn't heard of that one before. But there you go. So obviously, the oncologists who deal with the cancer will be very well aware of that, and it will not go around obviously trying to make a difficult situation even worse.
No, absolutely. I was going to say, it's really interesting because, like, I know, like, with the whole thing with, like, long COVID and stuff and, like, the COVID jabs and everything, because obviously sometimes people have obviously been quite poorly after them. I know obviously you have knowledge of that kind of a situation as well. And I know with my, so obviously I've always been very open with my health. So I have POTS, which is postural tachycardia syndrome, which basically means that I can get lightheaded. And I need to have more salt than usual. I need to make sure I drink lots of water, different things like that. But basically, it's all to do with the way that my blood pressure changes when I stand up. Quite likely, my sister and my mum have it as well, though they've not been diagnosed with anything. But, you know, my mum had, this is just going back to what you said about the virus, I know I've gone completely off topic here, but my mum had the COVID booster and suddenly became very, very ill and became very symptomatic with POTS. And obviously she'd kind of like had symptoms so-so through her life, nothing like really extensive to like massively having symptoms. And then actually having, you know, we got the diagnosis of POTS for her, and obviously she's still getting some support with that because she's still not particularly well. But what was interesting though is that I remember seeing that the POTS specialist had basically done some information about and basically saying how they felt that long COVID might actually be in some ways POTS or triggering POTS in people, and that if people look at, if they have it, if they look at like getting, seeing, checking they've got POTS to see if it can help and they can be treated that way. But like you say, that's, again, that's a virus. And again, it's that thing, isn't it, of a virus doing something to the heart and causing a moment for the heart.
It's
quite scary.
I'm certainly no expert whatsoever on viruses, but it's, as I say, no smoke without fire.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure there's certainly evidence to prove one way or the other on that. So yeah, it's interesting. In terms of diagnosis, it is notoriously difficult to diagnose, and you don't really start to look into it from a medical perspective, like that person doesn't present with any symptoms, and sadly because of that you often get these significant cardiac events happening, as in at the most extreme, sudden death. That person or the family didn't even know that they had a cardiomyopathy, and therefore only got to know about that at post-mortem, which is obviously very, very sad. And certainly in the last 20 years or so, particularly in the USA, they've actually started screening high school athletes
with
cardiac issues. Because they were finding far too many young, healthy athletes were dropping dead and having these, because, let me say dropping dead, that sounds a bit flippant, which I apologise, but cardiac events which have caused their death. And they started to realize that their cardiomyopathies were involved and completely undiagnosed and completely asymptomatic, bear in mind they were athletes. But they've introduced screening programs, and in some states it's reduced the deaths by 90%.
Oh, wow.
It's
That's
huge.
not a small amount.
So it's 90% of what was the starting point. It's another, is that wonderful statistic, but nevertheless, 90% is still a huge, huge figure, as you just said. So again, it just shows, I think, here that very fit, totally asymptomatic individuals, if they suddenly have an unexpected, when you're actually racing as opposed to training, let's say, push on the heart, then that heart muscle can suddenly, it won't be doing its job properly, potentially cause an arrhythmia, and I'm afraid it's terminal. So it just, again, I'd really kind of tell that because it's very, as I say, just to say, difficult to diagnose.
Of course.
In terms of diagnosis, then a cardiac MRI, magnetic resonating. Oh dear, dear.
One of those things, you go in the
Cardiac
tube.
MRI is the gold standard for diagnosis of to make sure that the left ventricle is working properly. And yes, magnetic resonance imaging, if I can spit it out. I really have left my teeth upstairs today. Okay. In terms of treatment, no, there's no absolute cure really. But the symptom can be treated, and no surprises that once you have a diagnosis, then it's the severity of the symptoms will dictate what treatment you get. Mild disease is often treated with lifestyle modifications. Avoid strenuous exercise, heavy lifting, and you can get drug treatment with beta blockers, which helps.
I was going to say, I think a key thing here, Matt, as well, and I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure I'm right on it. I'm thinking, especially from an underwriting point of view, that being a smoker would not be seen as a positive.
It wouldn't help, no.
No,
Nope.
that's
No.
usually that's the general thing that I tend to come across. If there's a heart thing and someone's a smoker, that often makes things much harder to get the insurance.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, totally agree. In terms of treatment again, and things that I think you might touch on this a little bit later on, Catherine, is surgical intervention. So I'm not talking about heart transplants here, but I'm talking about surgically implanted devices to allow the heart to do better. So I'm coming on to the underwriting outcomes, which are not particularly complicated. But shall I move on to those, or did you want to
I
talk
think
about
probably
these?
one other thing for me to check with you, because I know that a big thing, so like you say, underwriting outcomes. So obviously, when anybody is doing this from an advice point of view, as it's pretty standard, you check people. What were you diagnosed with? When were you diagnosed with it? What are the symptoms that you're having, or have they stopped? Have they resolved? What are your treatment medication? But with the hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, I would also be asking, do they know the thickness of the heart wall? I don't know what thickness of the heart wall is meant to be. I know where it starts to be seen as so-so, that there could be the hypertrophic cardiomyopathy there, and there's evidence there by the MRI. But is there like a kind of like a range, Matt, where you'd be
Yeah,
like,
there is a range. I'm afraid I can't remember what it is, top of my
okay.
head, but there certainly is a range. But I also think that the medics will also look at the lifestyle of the individual. For instance, if you're a marathon runner, it's likely that your left ventricle is going to be athlete's heart, I believe it's called, a little bit thicker than the average man in the street, because the left ventricle has to work harder to get the blood pump around the body to cope with all the needs of the body.
So an
So
athlete would natural so an athlete would have a thicker
could.
cut. So
Yeah.
okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's really interesting.
Particularly because the on long distance runners, because of the requirement of oxygen for a long period of time, as opposed to necessarily 100-meter runners or 60-meter runners, where it's highly very, very intense. But it's a bit like your heart. If you exercise your biceps or any other part of your body, your muscles will start to grow. It's the
Yeah, of
same with the
course.
heart. Okay, but that's completely natural. But it's, as I say, you can get that with athletes. And so it's one of those things that the doctors will need to look at the results in relation to other areas such as exercise and
Yes.
so on and so forth. But yes, certainly the size of the left ventricle, rather like this it helps with diagnoses, and certainly the echocardiogram, which is also used with the diagnosis of cardiomyopathy, will give you a good view of that. But sometimes echoes, I understand, can be a little bit inconclusive. So this is where your cardiac MRI comes in. Then that's it. That is the gold standard test
Yeah.
for cardiomyopathy. Does that help a little bit? So as
Yeah,
far as I'm
definitely.
aware, the ratings that I've explored don't specifically talk about a left ventricular wall thickness, as far as I can see. I must admit, when you you ask that question, I do seem to maybe remember years and years ago them being around, but I think looking at the overall way that the ratings are expressed, I think they're looking a lot more as a generalized comment as opposed to one particular element.
Yeah.
Look at the case in the round as opposed to just focusing on left ventricular thickness. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
Okay, so in terms of the underwriting outcomes, they're not going to be great, as you can probably imagine from what I've said. For a start, insurers will only consider life
Yes.
contracts only, so no critical illness and no income protection.
Yeah.
The applicant has to be over the age of 40 and been actually formally diagnosed for more than 3 years. Okay. As I've alluded to already, and hence why I use the New York classification on heart failure, the cardiomyopathy HCM needs to be considered an NYHA, so New York, da-da-di-da, class one, with no symptoms, current symptoms, no history of cardiac arrest, and no family history of sudden death. So that's quite, it feels pretty restricted, doesn't it? In terms of the rating, the ratings themselves, then between the ages of 40 and 59, you're looking at, in underwriting terms, a rating of plus 150, which is about 2.45 times normal terms. And then over the age of 60, plus 75, which is around 1.7 times normal rates. Any implanted cardioverter defibrillator, we talked about these surgical devices that can be used in terms of treatment. Unfortunately, it would be a decline.
Oh, you
So,
say that, Matt.
sorry.
You say that, but remember, I've got a case study.
Oh no, absolutely. Hence why I was interested in your case study. And again, I think it comes down to, I think it's always very difficult with medical underwriting, I have to say, because it leaves an awfully big ask on the advisor to know sometimes the ins and outs and where underwriters can be a little bit more lenient.
Yes,
But I think
it's
the
not easy.
case that you have and now have incorporated it into the curers' work practices, it proves that point. But as I say, all I would also say to that is it could well be that some insurers would decline either with the scenario which you come to mention, but fortunately for your client, you found somebody who would take it into account.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, I mean, I
So
think.
it's around no you, the knowledge of your IFA for a start, and B, like I've always said, with many of the conditions that we've spoken about over the months, is don't just go to one insurer. Do look at the marketplace as a whole, because insurers do have different views on medical conditions, as we've highlighted many times.
Absolutely.
So,
So,
Catherine, over to you, I think, unless you have
yeah.
specific questions then.
No, I think that's all completely fair. I mean, obviously, when we're talking about this, we are talking a lot in the personal market. And you know, obviously, if you know what I wouldn't want people to think if they're not covered by a group scheme through work, that they suddenly think, oh, hang on, am I not covered? The majority of the time you will be. If you've got a group insurance policy, they do have what's known as a certain amount of free cover level limits where they won't take into account medical history, but that isn't the way that that is done. That free cover level limit isn't necessarily consistent across the market as to the way that insurers' views are. So if you do have a condition like this, you are covered what's known as death in service cover through your employer. Then it is always worth getting that policy wording out, speaking to an advisor who can then, you know, just double check that you are actually covered the way that you expected or believe that you to be covered. A lot of the time it's absolutely fine, but just sometimes we need to just make a double check and make sure. So in terms of case study then, we were chatting about somebody that I supported. So this person, when we applied for the cover, was in their mid-40s. They were a non-smoker, and they'd been diagnosed about 5 years with 5 years beforehand with the hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. So they were early 40s when they were diagnosed. Now, with this person, one of the things that we checked, because it is part of the, it really, really helps your underwriting research. And again, managing your expectations, managing the client's expectations, if you find out the thickness of the heart wall. So the heart wall for this person was between 20 to 25 millimeters. You don't tend to get like a super exact amount. You do tend to get a range. But that is obviously, it just helps the insurer to understand what's happening, the underwriter to understand what is happening with that heart wall. And then obviously they then go into all the philosophies and the statistics that have worked, been worked out by actuaries and everything as to what that then means in terms of somebody's life expectancy and things like that. Now, what was interesting with this person that I insured was that they did have an ICD fitted, which, as Matt, as you've said, usually if an ICD is fitted, it would indicate that the condition has progressed quite significantly to get to the point where an ICD, it has been warranted, because a lot of people don't need an ICD with this condition. They may have other treatments, they may have some medications, it might just be lifestyle factors that have been used to improve the symptoms. But this person had. Now, this is something that I will sometimes bring into my research, and it is something that I train my team to check as well. So with this one, as I was chatting to the person, we were discussing it, and it came out that this ICD had been fitted through private medical treatment. So it had been put in on a precautionary basis. It wasn't reactive. So not all the time, but quite a lot of the time, if somebody's had treatment on the NHS, it has been more of a reactive type of treatment. So just because of sheer volume and resource and everything like that. So this person did have private medical insurance. They'd been diagnosed with condition, and as with private medical insurance, at times the specialist consultants, they all just go, right, should we just do this while we're in here having a look? Yeah, why not, kind of thing. So it had all been approved. They hadn't been, so I find this quite a bit with heart conditions and also sometimes with cancers, not always, but sometimes, is that like a big way, if I just sidetracked cancer a little bit, a big way for underwriters to understand the way that somebody's cancer has been, how strong it's been and how much it's affected them, is sometimes understanding how much treatment they've had. Because when we're doing cancers, it's usually staging and grading that we need to establish, say, the strength of the cancer, what the cells were doing. But then, you know, there can be times where maybe somebody's had, they're telling you they've had quite a low staging grading cancer, but then their treatment has seemed like what you would usually expect for a much stronger one. And then at that point, you know, obviously you yourself, the advisor, the underwriter can be a little bit confused, because in the case, well, hang on, that treatment doesn't necessarily match up with what we would expect for that. Just like with this person, we wouldn't expect an ICD to be fitted for this level of symptom that you're telling us, because the assumption is that people have had the treatment on the NHS, which it does tend to not be as fast as the private medical. I'm not saying that's always the case, but it does tend to be that way. And you do tend to get more like this one, the precautionary treatment as well, through private medical rather than through the NHS. I say not always, just that's what tends to happen. So it's always worth checking with certain things. You know, if the underwriter said to you, oh, really, this doesn't seem to be adding up, just go back to your client and just say, can I just check, was this NHS or private? And then that can sometimes really answer the situation. So with this person, I say they were Well, they were getting towards the later 40s, mid to late 40s. It was £1.1 million worth of life insurance over 10 years, and the premium did become out at £240 per month. So that premium there was a mixture. It was a mixture of the age, how long they'd been diagnosed for, and obviously the fact that there had been that ICD fitted, yes, as precautionary, but in terms of the symptoms that had been there at the time as well. So, well, the brilliant thing about that is that obviously ICD fitted standard in the manuals was decline, but we managed to obviously get that human aspect to it, get around the background and go, well, actually, that manual is based upon this assumption, whereas we've not had that. That's not what's happened. And luckily, we were able to get that cover in place. So that's my case study, Matt. Is there anything that you want to comment on or question about or have
No, not
anatta
really. I
about?
mean, I certainly I'm thinking about the ICD for your client, and I'm thinking to myself, by the way, this is just a thought, but is there a lot more to that case that would have made the insurer or would have allowed the insurer to provide terms? I'm just
I mean,
trying.
maybe.
Positive features is really what I'm trying to get at here.
Yeah, I mean, there was no smoking, fit and active, so there
Okay.
was,
There would have been other issues that allowed the underwriters to put it through, as opposed to the precautionary bit, because,
That was quite a key bit when I was well, got the feedback. Obviously, I won't necessarily have all the feedback, but the feedback had been very, specific that the fact that it had been done as precautionary meant that it went from, in a sense, automatic decline to we can potentially consider. So I think that's the key thing there. It's not necessarily been the be all and end all. There could have still been things that could have changed it, but it went from the we're not
Yeah,
prepared
no,
to accept an
absolutely.
application to show us the medical letters and let's see what we can do.
Absolutely. It kind of proves to me, not for the first time in my career, in fact, it happens an awful lot, to be honest with you, that trying to push cases into spaces is fraught with difficulty, because sometimes the reality is not every single case is the same, and there could always be nuances in a case which would allow in this case particular situation terms to be given. But it also brings back to one of my bugbears about it probably, in fact, for 1.1 million, it definitely would have done. It would have brought a human and a human underwriter. As a I shall take back human underwriter completely. A person to spot that it wasn't, including yourself, I have to say, an underwriter to say, well, that doesn't absolutely fit together with the story that's being presented. Perhaps we can look at this in a different way. And if you try and with the chemotherapy thing, I certainly noticed over the last 5, 10 years that chemotherapy has been given a much lesser. Traditionally, it happens at stage three on a cancer, but now you're certainly seeing it quite a bit on a stage two. And that is because, I believe, because of the understanding of the way the cancer spread has developed an awful lot since over the last 10 years. And therefore, that traditional, oh well, stage three equals chemo, is not necessarily being thrown out of the window. But the oncologists are now saying, well, actually, that's a bit black and white. Let's have a look at this particular cancer. And also, genetics are absolutely showing, just genetic modelling, sorry, investigations, that particular cancers in particular people will spread in a very different way. So this classific, we talk about classifications and so on and so forth. I'm not sure if it'll happen in my lifetime, but I think, and if you read all the articles that are flying around in the medical press, it's much more, particularly around immunotherapy, it is much more around tailoring the treatment to that individual. The old adage of class three equals chemotherapy, I think, could well, even if it isn't now, will be seen as a very dinosaur, a bit of a prehistoric approach treatments
Right.
very much depend on the individual, so not a group of men aged 50 or a group of ladies aged 26. It'll be much down to that more that individual, which I think is absolutely fascinating to my mind and why I love underwriting so much. But I'm very glad that your client found terms.
Well,
I,
I'm very, very
end
glad
of
to.
story,
I was very,
really.
very glad to be able to do
Yeah,
it.
absolutely. It's great, and I'm glad an underwriter somewhere picked it up and realised that, that a precautionary private in this particular instance, device being fitted was not the same as somebody has already had a cardiac event, and it's been fitted to stop any future, or as best they can, stop any future events.
Yeah.
No, it was purely based on well, look, we know that arrhythmias can be a problem with cardiomyopathy. In order to prevent as best we can that stop that happening, then let's put a precautionary one in.
Yeah.
Makes perfect sense, really, doesn't it, to my
It
mind?
does. Absolutely. And I have to say,
But
in
it takes
terms of what.
somebody to know that. That's the thing, and say, look, hold on, this rating category consists of these assumptions. This one doesn't fit into that assumption. Therefore, let's have another look at it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think one of the things as well as just feedback as well is that in terms of what we're seeing currently in the market, it is really quite tricky to get cover at the moment if somebody does have hypertrophic
Yeah,
cardiomyopathy. And I think it's really one of those ones as well where it's incredibly hard if you don't have the medical records in front of you before you go for it. It just needs to be one slight thing. You know, they've just happened to have been to a GP and they've said, how's your heart doing? Oh yeah, it's fine. Or maybe a little flutter or something, you know, or anything like, you know, and it's noted. And then that completely throws, you know, the options, you know, it's a lot of the time at the moment it is having to go quite specialist. But you never know. And it's always worth trying. So yeah. So
Totally and utterly agree. Yeah.
thank you for listening, everybody. And thank you as always, Matt, for joining me.
My pleasure.
It's been a pleasure to have you. Next time, I am going to be doing an overview of relevant life insurance. It is something that we see quite a lot of in terms of people chatting on, you know, different social medias and different things like that about when you can and can't use it. I will be talking about the age-old debate of, you know, can you set up relevant life insurance to cover a mortgage? And hopefully people will find it useful. As always, you can visit the website practical-protection.co.uk to listen to our other episodes and also to get your CPD certificate. Thank you to our sponsors, the Oxford members, for that. So thank you very much, everybody, for listening. And Matt, I will speak to you soon.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.